Welcome to buying system number two, buying properties through the MLS existing inventory. This is the close cousin to buying system number one, buying out of the MLS. After Bruce walks you through the how-to of this system, we're joined once again by longtime realtor and investor Andrea Jennings, who will share when the strategy works best and the most important piece to making your phone ring automatically when inventory starts to linger.
Buying system number two. This is buying properties through the MLS where you have the existing inventory. And basically the way I approached it is we divided the areas up into eight separate sections. And if I moved into an area where no one knew me at all, in an eight-week process, I could become a household name using this system. And I could come up to speed in any county about knowing values because of the way I'll approach this. Remember, while we do this system number two, we're also doing system number one, so we're constantly catching the deals that are below market. But now we're going to go after the inventory that's priced a little below market, and I'm going to do an eighth of my inventory per week. So let's say I live in Riverside. I'll do Riverside 1 week, Marina Valley 1 week, Corona 1 week, and I'll just make that system until I'm done with eight areas, okay? I would pull the entire MLS inventory for that city. I'm going to ignore a great many of the listings. What I'm looking for is something that indicates that it's below market. I'm looking for inventory that gives me a running start. Maybe it's only 80 cents on the dollar. Maybe it's not cheap enough to buy and resell and make a profit. It is lender-owned, and it's going to get an offer under system number two, because what I want to do now is I want to offer on everything in the city that has a running start at 20% off. So you're going to present a lot of offers. Your name's going to go from who's Bruce to, oh yeah, that guy. As long as it's done reasonably, respectively, you know what? We had a reputation. When we used to do the small boot camps, we never had people respond that were brokers going, oh yeah, we hate that guy. What we did have is people say, oh, that guy's buy really cheap. Okay, well, that the first reputation I don't want. The second reputation I do want. I want them to know that I'm a wholesale buyer. And because of our exposure to the market, they understood what we did. Anything that shows me that it's below market gets my attention under system number two and is going to get an offer. Most of the time, you're going to see a reason for it in the comment section. So if you're looking at a property, you're going to have pages and pages of listings, and maybe only one out of every 30 listings will match the criteria that it's below market. But it's not below market enough to have attracted an offer. So we're going to make an offer according to one of our formulas, and it's going to be probably a lot different than their asking price. So you're not going to get an awful lot of accepted offers. You do buy properties this way, but there's other reasons to do this system besides buying properties. But you will buy them. It's a tedious process, and you have to make a lot of offers. So you look at the comments that are in the section to see why. Is it lender-owned? Is it in foreclosure? Are they trying to do a short sale? Once I find the reason that exists of why this property is below market, I'm going to make an offer. And I want the property to have at least a 20% running start. You're wasting your time, I think, if you just take a retail price and try to beat them up all the way down to a wholesale number. It's not going to work. So you have to have a property that's at least below market somewhat. Make an offer on each of those properties. The key is to follow up on your offers. And again, this is where your agent is absolutely necessary. You follow up on these offers to see if the attitude has changed. That happens. Especially as you approach the end of the listing. I've actually noticed the listing agent's attitude change toward the end of their listing because they're about ready to lose a listing and maybe a relationship. So when you make a low offer, a lot of times it'll have a better audience toward the end of the listing cycle. But as your agent follows up with the offer, it's very important that they ask the following question. First of all, is there any update on our offer that we've made? And are you working on any other properties that are not in the MLS yet? that are in the BPO process that we can see. So that's buying system number two, is that we're really going after the inventory, but also the inventory that's not in the MLS yet. What's typical of the agent that has these listings that aren't selling in the MLS is they're that agent that's trying to get relationships with the lenders, but they're not strong enough to get them priced right to where they sell right away. So they need work, they're 20% below market, and they just sit there. They sit there and they expire. So I'm not so interested in the relationship with this agent. I'm interested in the inventory that they might be working on, or is there anybody else in your office that works on lender inventory as well, trying to build a relationship with maybe the next group of people that'll produce inventory for us. If you go through this cycle 8 times in a 2-month period, you literally will have covered 8 different cities, made offer on every property that has a hint of being below market, and made yourself a household name as a buyer. You will have bought some properties, but what happens is you've created yourself an aura of, this guy buys a lot of houses. Now, you may not have in fact bought very many, but you've given the indication that you are a willing buyer in a market. And that's important for future inventory. People will start calling you directly with inventory, or calling the agent that works with you before things hit the MLS. And that happens quite a bit. And originally, when I started doing this business, I would have thought that most of the deals out of the MLS that were bought at bargains were the ones that were in the MLS the longest. And that's not true. The great deals are the ones that are listed the first day at the super price. All this other inventory we sort of have to beat up to get down to our level. I'd rather have them just resign themselves so they have to sell it cheap right up front. That's a lot easier. So you'll write this offer on the standard MLS forms. You might have a verbal sparring going on, even if you have a relationship with the agent or they have a relationship with your agent. A lot of times it doesn't really get reduced to writing until you've kind of come to an agreement. Deposits can be 1% of the offer, a minimum of $1,000. Short escrows are not as important here because there's not as much competition. You still probably want to have a 14-day escrow because you do want to get control of the property. You won't necessarily need proof of funds until you get close to an acceptance. So again, you're not dealing with the same process of maybe multiple offers when it's just sitting there in the MLS. You always will submit this offer through your agent and have your agent follow up on the offer every couple of weeks. I would not change our offer. Sometimes when they come back and they say, well, you know, what about this? A lot of times I want to stick to my guns because I want them to understand that we want to buy properties at exactly what we've offered. We have a formula that works, and we're going to give you our best shot up front. It's pretty much how I'd rather buy the property. On occasion, you have a relationship with an agent that controls inventory, and it's very important to understand who you have. There's agents that list properties that will lie through their teeth, and there's other agents that tell you exactly where the lender is in advance. And if you think that all of them are the same, it's wrong. So I've tried to play the big discount game with the second type of agent, where the agent is telling you the truth. And it was a decent deal, but not a great deal, and lost the house because I was trying to turn it into a great deal. And they were telling me the truth. The lender would take this number, but no less. And because I didn't say yes, it went into the MLS and sold. And so I missed a chance. So sometimes you have to really know who you're dealing with so you don't miss the opportunity. So this system number two, it gets you name recognition with 8 areas. And combined with system number one, in a 2-month period, you are pretty much caught up. You know what the values are in an area, and you also have made a habit of looking at day number one for anything that was a super deal in the MLS. And how you figure it out is you look for square footage differentials, to where if you see something that's just a lot larger than other properties in that price range, then you look in the comment section and see why that is. And usually, sure enough, it'll be lender owned.
Okay, today we are talking about buying properties through the MLS existing inventory. We're here with Bruce and Andrea, who worked together through several cycles, as both have done, worn the investor hat as well as the realtor hat. So existing inventory, a very different process than the first day. First day is about speed and the relationship. Existing inventory, not quite the same, and it's going to change by quadrant. So quadrant one, we're talking about a flattening out, coming out of a boom cycle. We talked during the last buying system about looking for the people that had done the REOs in the last cycle.
Correct. The when you get into quadrant one, most agents, first of all, are not aware there's about to be a change. They're not going to be REO agents, and they probably never will be. What they're going to do is start having no income, mm-hmm. and they're going to have listings that last a lot longer than they thought. A lot of times you'll see lenders revisit a listing after it's been so long, and they'll start whacking it off mm-hmm. a percent, 5% of time or something like that. And if you could time your offer right when they were in the mood to make that next cut, and you could make an offer, you know, you have a little bit of a margin already built in because they're about to drop it again anyway.
Right.
And so, but it's more a methodical process.
Well, let's talk about the offers really quick, because that's interesting. So they're ratcheting down. Does this mean that they're not getting offers, or people are falling through, the lenders aren't lending, you know?
Well, what your dad was just saying, when you talk about that, you have to remember that the agent that has that listing mm-hmm. is doing the BPOs, is doing the monthly marketing reports, is telling the bank, okay, here is what we have done to try to sell your listing.
Okay.
And it's not working.
And they're not getting paid for anything yet.
And they're not getting paid for anything. So that is a real indicator if the property's not moving, and the bank really has to wake up and say, okay, here's what our realtor is telling us. This isn't going to sell, so we're going to have to start reducing our prices. Usually after something is set for 90 days is when they really will do another appraisal, and then they'll really start to reevaluate if they want to start taking much bigger chunks off of the price. So a lot of times if you have something that's set for 90 plus days, which is a search I run, mm-hmm. I know that we're going to start seeing, especially if it's an REO, a lot more motivation.
And if it's an equity seller about that time frame, this specific quadrant, and it's lingering, man, that journey with the seller's agent has got to be rough, because it's lingering. You know, they've just come off watching, you know, the boom market. Who's worse, the bank or the equity seller?
Well, I'm going to be diplomatic here, but you have to remember sellers, you know, if you're talking about that particular market, have taken a lot of money usually out of their property.
Haven't thought about that.
Yes. And then they're saying, when we go on a listing appointment, what do you mean I'm only going to get 10 grand? And you're like, no, you've already gotten 150 grand.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't count anymore.
Yeah, all of a sudden that doesn't matter, right?
The other transition that's really important to realize is the mentality of the buyer shifts drastically.
It does.
So in quadrant four, you show them a house. I'm sorry, it doesn't have a front door. It doesn't have a lawn. No problem.
And
I'm being serious. I mean, you could sell anything that's real estate. Quadrant one, that attitudes start to change where you go. So you pull up in front of a roof in quadrant four, and it's like got some shingles off. That's fine. I can fix it. Quadrant one. Quadrant two, heck no, it's got to have a new roof. And so now all of those things that are marginal that were okay selling in quadrant four all of a sudden become not sellable in quadrant one and definitely discountable in quadrant two. Mm-hmm. And so the longer that stuff waits, that's why taking the first loss is smart if you're on the selling side, because it's only going to grow. Because the attitude of the buyer in quadrant two, when it's really bad, gets, it's got to be perfect or I'm not going to buy it.
Okay, that makes sense. And so this also sounds like a very important relationship building piece as well that works well with the first day. But you're dealing
with not the same people.
It isn't.
You're not dealing with the same skill level of an agent. It isn't going to be a repetitive agent probably either. But what it is good for is creating a comp. So when you get one of these, you now have a comp to walk around to quadrant one. I'm sorry, into buying system one.
Okay.
So that's how that works. So you, when I met Steve Silva, he had an offer, a listing with B of A, and it was at 85 grand. I made an offer at 35, and he called up angry. Well, what do you think? What am I supposed to do with this? I said, well, submit it, get it accepted. I said, I'd like to do that, pal, but you know, why would you make such a low offer? I said, well, obviously you're not familiar, and we had just bought a pile of the Edgemont properties
right.
for like 28 and 35 grand.
Right.
So I sent him over those. And he went, oh, my God. I said, I've never seen anything like this. I want to meet you. Well, that was evidence. Mm-hmm. So anytime you get anything like a comp, and it, if it's
doesn't have to be yours.
If it's existing listing or whatever, that's right. You can walk that around and make other inventory happen. So that's the existing inventory is susceptible to comps. And that's so it's lingered and lingered, but all of a sudden here's evidence that the game has changed. And you've got a bunch of comps at the offer that you've had that you're making. That has some weight when they can go back to a company, if it's company owned, or even a person and say, this is going down.
This is the story.
This is the wrong direction.
And putting on the realtor hat, would you prefer a shark of an investor to tell that story? Is it helpful at all when they bring the comps? Because, I mean, you have access to the comps as well. But is it easier if somebody else is delivering the bad news?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things that was great about Bruce was when we were doing these offers was he would, you know, we had these comps. So we already had an argument in place to say, you know, you might be at 85, but, you know, we just bought three of them at 45.
Okay.
So why, how can you justify yours being at 85?
When do repairs matter? So we were just talking about, you know, comps. This is just a comp. They're not expecting you to tell the story like, this is what we're going to do to the property. Here's a repair list.
Well, it really depends on the type of seller that you're dealing with. Because remember, if you're dealing with an REO, they've hired an agent who is supposed to have made a pretty comprehensive story for them, okay, with pictures and repairs and bids. And they are needing to know exactly what they're dealing with. Because you got to remember, they're either, you know, in Washington or Seattle. They're not here in the state. And they have this inventory. So it's really up to the agent, that listing agent. And you need a good, strong listing agent who's telling the bank, you know what, you don't want to repair this property. It is not worth it for you to repair this property. Sell it to an investor and move on.
Doesn't sound like we're agents during the, sort of that period last time, doing a good job doing those repair estimates? I mean, there's so many so fast. How do you go from 0 to 60 and do a good job with all your lists of things to do?
And you have a good team.
You do. Okay. So you feel like overall...
And that's why there are really good REO agents and then agents that didn't stay in the business.
So, I think what happened is originally when you started, let's say, the quadrant in quadrant two in 2008, there were no sales. So you had a loan that was 365 and you had no sales. You had a big pocket of air. And then the first sale was 180 or something. You're going,
jeez.
And all of a sudden, you know, and they weren't going to reduce the price to that point for a while. So that was, you know, in quadrant two, it took a while for them to realize we're completely in trouble here.
Okay. So let's dig into quadrant two. So you've got the equity sellers that are probably just hating life and they just don't understand what's going on. And Zillow is, you know, these estimate, these automated value systems really can't keep up with how quickly it's probably moving because it's always looking back at past data. And to get ahead of the market is just, it's hard. So as a realtor or an REO agent, a short sale, when is a good time to start hitting them up? Is it that 90-day time frame when, you know, the system, and can you ask, like, how often do they review the file to know when it's time to...
Yeah, are we talking about, like, an 08 market?
Yeah, lower the price. So as we get into 09 and a 10, where it's clear it's devastated.
I can't tell you how many... we call them BPOs, broker price opinions. I can honestly say I've done thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is what your bank is relying on because you get that property in what we call the pre-foreclosure stage. So they're asking you to go out, look at it. Is it occupied, unoccupied, you know, and evaluate it then. So that's their first evaluation. Then once it goes through the foreclosure process, then they're asking you to do another evaluation. So they're steadily getting a picture of what that property is. But in 08, they weren't realistic in what their price was going to be. And so we would have inventory that would linger because their appraisal would be at 350 and they would be listing at 250. And as you know, Bruce said, the comp in the neighborhood was 180.
Mm-hmm.
It took them that time to understand that, oh, you want to sell it? Now you're going to be at 150.
You're right. They're always behind the curve.
Exactly.
Because it was sinking that fast. That's really an unusual market. You know, I don't know that we'll ever repeat that. But I was going to say, too, when you have buying system number two kick in, you're dealing with lengthy inventory, you also can have a change of circumstance for the people that own it. They may be presented with an opportunity or they may get really tired of it. And so I can remember circumstances, and I've been one of the circumstances. When we adopted Sarah, mm-hmm. before that we had to have a house with one more bedroom than the house that we moved into when you were a kid.
Right.
Okay, so we had a small bedroom. When we got through that counseling stuff, I had to find a bigger home. I found it. I needed to cash out the rental I had on Main Street in Grand Terrace and the one we lived in on Kendra. Mm-hmm. There was it was listed at the time for $85,000, and an investor made an offer for $62,000, and the agent didn't even give it to me because he was embarrassed. And in a conversation now, I'm saying, are we having any activity? He says, oh my God. I'm so embarrassed. He said, I got this ridiculous offer. I'm so embarrassed. And he tells me the offer. And I'm doing the math, and I've got another model match pretty much up the street. I said, I'll only accept this if he'll buy the other house I have on Main Street for the same price. You know, and the next sound you hear is like the guy falling off the chair because he's not in trouble. He gets two commissions.
Right.
Because my circumstance changed. Mm-hmm. I didn't care about retail because I was buying a $150,000 house for $79,000. Okay, so the discount was already in place. Could I fund it was the question. Mm-hmm. So sometimes things change, and there's opportunities that happen, and people just go, okay, something else is more important.
And now with technology changing and making it very transparent, what do you keep an eye on? So during the downturn, is it somebody who's changing it every week or just a huge chunk? Like, how would we sort of know who's motivated, who's not?
You know, for me, it's always days on market because of being an REO agent and being an investor. I have worked for different banks, so I kind of know their mentality. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm always contacting that agent when I see they're hitting close to that 90-day mark or that 100-day mark because they've just completed their third BPO.
Ah, okay.
Or their third market analysis. And they're telling that bank, you've got to drop the price. So I'm wanting to get my offer in prior to that price getting dropped on the MLS. And the agent already knows if they're going to get a price reduction or not. So if you're saying, you know, hey, can you just put my offer in at what you've been asking the bank for the last 100 days to price it at? Mm-hmm. I bought one over on Nelson Street a few years ago that had been a Fannie Mae, and it had fallen out of escrow 5 times. And finally, I just kept writing offers on it. Writing offers. And finally, escrow number 5 that fell out, the agent called me and got my offer through because the bank finally just got realistic. Mm. You know, we need to get this thing off the books, and we've fallen out with owner occupants 5 times.
So it's follow up.
There's times, too, that you see a picture of risk. When we had boot camps and we were doing it monthly, there was a house in Marina Valley visited for 3 months in a row.
Yeah.
So first time I went there with the boot camp, just a disheveled house with an empty pool. Next time, it was a pool that was filled with water by a pose over the fence with kids in it. This next time we went, the third time, it was a green pool, half-filled, and now they had built a skate ramp on the driveway.
Oh.
And so, you know, if you were thinking about, if I had just captured this in pictures for a lender, says, yeah, go ahead and keep your REO for as long as you want, but this is the progression of risk that takes place, and it's real.
So this is about follow-up and helping you tell the story.
Some of it's also really understanding the mechanics of some stuff. Okay, so you have a vacant house and it's been listed for 120 days. You're not insured. You think you're insured, but you're not. You have a vacant policy? I doubt it.
Right.
You have a rental policy. You have an own homeowner's policy. If it's vacant for 30 days, you're not insured. So that's a risk you're taking. Is it okay? Oh, you have an estate and it's all in the same name? So in other words, there's some times where you have a lot more risk than you're acknowledging. And that's our job, is to say, you know what? You really don't want somebody to move into it next door to you. Mm-hmm. Aaron lives next door to somebody that's moved in a year now, and they're making themselves at home.
Yeah, they're repairing the roof, and I the tax records are wrong. So both the city, I'm actually working with the city trying to find, I hired a private investigator, hunted down this guy, called him, and he was so indignant about it. It was a trip. I'm glad this one's not going to be on the radio show. He was like, yeah, it's boarded up. I'm all, up until a year ago when somebody moved in and started repairing your house. He's like, what? He had no idea. He's so unplugged. He lives up in Northern California, absentee owner, and he was proud that it was boarded up. He's not returning my phone calls right now. So, interesting. So following up is important. I think saying that, I need to write that offer.
Sometimes asking what other people aren't willing to ask is important too. So you're going to get some unfortunate responses. But when I started the business, I didn't know anything. Didn't have any contacts. I bought 10 houses the first month. because I asked people that had 225 grand listings if they would sell it for 125 or 130. And lo and behold, 10 people said yes, when no one else would make that offer because you got yelled at 90% of the time like you're an idiot.
Mm. Yeah, and when you're talking about the quadrant, you know, that 08 to that really 11 kind of market, so many people lost their jobs. You have to remember
right,
that.
Right.
I mean, so many people were unemployed. They were just trying to figure out how they were going to survive and take care of their families.
Yeah.
And so there were people that, you know, may have had some equity in those properties, but there was no way for them to refinance.
Right.
There was no way for them. They had no solutions.
Right.
So it was either short sale, foreclose, or if they were in a position of having some equity, you know, sell to an investor. People's circumstances really factor into why they're needing to sell their house.
One of the things that happened, and this, so when I got in the business, it was at the end of a quadrant four. Mm. So everybody had equity, everything had gone really well. But if you were a builder, you were the first one to realize it had changed. And you have construction loans with a time bomb. So six or seven of those homes I bought were builder homes that their construction loan had ended and the payments had begun. And yeah, what they thought was worth 225, they sold for 125 just to pay off the construction loan.
Wow. Okay. Well, I guess I'll drop this question here. Is there's a sort of an inherent conflict of interest, and I think it really changed this last cycle where maybe the REO agent wasn't able to double end it, but perhaps somebody in their office could represent you as the buyer. Is that all a good strategy in, for this specific existing inventory strategy? Maybe going to, you know, somebody within the office, say, hey, I realize you probably can't double in this, but do you have somebody in your office who could work with me?
That's always a conversation I have.
Okay.
So when I find a property that I'm interested in, I will always contact the listing agent and say those exact words. You know, are you interested in representing me? I'm a cash buyer. I'll buy it as is. Or, you know, do you want to give me to somebody in your office because you don't want to double end it? And depending on how their team is structured, that really will be your answer. Some REO agents don't want to have anything to do with representing you.
Right.
And, I can understand that.
And some already have a team built into their office. But, you know, I just never generate an offer on a property. I always contact the listing agent. And if you can get them on the phone, you can really start to find out a little bit about how they work and what they want and if they already have an investor or if they're receptive to speaking to you and working with you.
And if they do have an investor, then just ask them, do you have any property that's driving you crazy?
Oh.
Because that's how you start proving yourself. So they give you the address from hell, basically, and you go see it, and they're surprised, and you've made an offer. You've done a lot of proving already. You've moved up way on the list just if you just react and go immediately see something.
Well, and if you're sort of working system one and two together, the first day you've done your homework, you've seen the property, at this point you're just following up. You know, especially if something's lingering, you've already seen it, you're already helping build the story. How often should investors follow up?
I can give you one incident that's really important is to check if that listing is expiring. Because what usually has happened, especially during REO cycles in quadrant two, you would be switching agents and then you'd see a radical price drop.
That's correct.
A radical price drop, maybe way below an offer that you had made on the stinking property.
That is correct.
Just have to make sure the price hasn't dropped with it that you should be paying for.
But I can tell you as an REO agent, that was really frustrating because you would get a property and you would continue to do those BPOs and tell them what they should list it at, and they win it. And then you get an email, we're reassigning this property, and then they reassign it and drop the price.
Oh, that's dirty.
Yeah, and so you'd get a bad grade and they'd get the commission.
Well,
but then the same thing was happening to you. You'd be getting their listings.
Exactly.
The
I mean,
thing.
We all just kind of, you know, cycled around.
What is nice with technology, too, it's a lot easier to keep track of the stuff. It's not in paper format. So thanks to Dropbox and emails, you know, it's easy to follow up. But as an agent who's been in this space, you know, is there investors that just bug you because they're following up too much?
If we're talking about the REO days, the 08 to 10, you could barely breathe in those days.
Oh, of course.
So you just really wanted an investor that you had worked with, because you had to remember back then we were going to bat for investors. We were saying, look, if you take this $50,000 price reduction, Bruce is going to close. You're going to get this off your books. Because a big thing back then was month-end closings.
Right.
They didn't want things moving into the next month.
Mm.
And you also have to remember a lot of asset managers back then, I don't know how it is now, worked on bonuses. So their amount that they closed in a certain month affected their bonus for that month.
Robots are going to be doing it soon, so yeah.
Those times have changed, though. I don't
really... Well, let's move into quadrant three and four. So three is sometimes you don't even know what's really happening. It sort of flattens out a little bit. It's going to be a little bit shorter. The existing inventory doesn't stick around maybe quite as long.
But my interest would be in the inventory that's still not of interest.
Right.
So then I would be thinking, okay, the product type that becomes acceptable in quadrant four is not acceptable in quadrant three and hasn't been in quadrant two. Land, condos, I mean, even, you know, decent condos. If you have a decent one-bedroom condo in 2010, who cares? If you have it in 2017, it's probably getting its turn now because you can't afford the house, so you're buying the condo. Okay, so you could have a nice little rental portfolio built in quadrant three of exactly what no one else wants and get them for a really good price. And I don't care if they're owned by – you're doing it in Florida. You're kind of beyond quadrant two now in Florida, but that condo is still below replacement cost, and it's the last thing that'll move. So that's how you think. You think inventory, a type, not just owner.
An area, too. It really shifts. When people can't afford, I mean, I have one listed right now. It's a 933 square foot house in Riverside for $315,000.
Wow. What a difference.
Multiple offers. Okay. So then you think that person who can't afford that or needs something bigger is now going to start considering going to San Jacinto or going to Hemet,
right,
which they wouldn't have. You know, but now we're going back to where when we were in that last boom where people simply were getting outpriced here in Riverside, and they were saying, you know, gosh, I don't think I mind if I drive out to Hemet or San Jacinto or Victorville or Hesperia.
Right.
Because that's changing too.
So for the existing inventory in quadrant three, it sort of starts to improve, and we're at now in quadrant four where it's a boom market, things are going great. What's the inventory that's sticking around now in a seller's market? What could possibly – is it just stuff that's ugly with severe problems?
Overpriced, that needs work with unrealistic sellers.
And investors willing to write offers sight unseen, so it just perpetuates the issue. Maybe that's why they're hanging out too long.
It's a progression, too. I mean, quadrant four is a progressive situation where it goes from, oh, we're going up now, to, wow, everything I touch is working so great, I don't even think there's risk involved. So somewhere in that spectrum, you know, quadrant four, it covers all those things where you first get happy and then you get cocky. And that's the part where when you're in the cocky stage, everything you touch, everyone wants. It doesn't matter what kind it is. And that's about the time when you start thinking, if we're approaching quadrant one again, I have to get out of dirt. I have to get out of condos. I have to get out of the things that will be unacceptable in any other quadrant but quadrant four at its peak.
Okay.
And that has location attached to it and it has type attached to it. Because in quadrant four, in a strong market, it's almost everything goes.
So do you like this as more of a follow-up buying strategy? So if you were marketing directly to sellers, so bought something off the MLS, and then going back to the MLS, and specifically maybe going back to the listings that have lingered a little bit too long, would that be your preference instead of, as an investor, doing this as a main strategy in four?
Well, the idea of walking the comp.
Right.
We used to start with the first day great purchases or the auction purchases and walk them into the MLS, and then it was sort of the evidence. So you have a fourplex listed at 150, but I just bought four of them in your neighbor for 60 grand, so...
Right.
Buying system one allowed for other purchases in other buying systems because it proved evidence that something was sold way below market.
At this point, off market sales, whether they happen through Redfin or Zillow, I think those are all getting pushed. That's what's very difficult about the MLS is, are there a lot of different MLS companies? And the data strategies change and they have different partnerships, which is hard to follow. But if there was an off-market MLS listing through one of those third-party technology platforms or even off-market, it was a for sale by owner, how long does it take to get into the MLS? Do you know? Or does it at all? I don't know, as comp goes.
It would get in the title company, but I don't know if it does it get in the MLS.
No, I mean, a lot of agents really who have mastered social media in this quadrant, because as Bruce says, everything is selling. They're not even putting their stuff in the MLS. They're taking the listings and having the seller sign the exclusion form. to exclude it from the MLS.
Why would they do that?
Because they're going to double end it.
They're going to
double end it. Their office is one of the two.
Exactly. And they're pre-marketing it. I mean, with social media now, the pre-marketing is so easy.
But what would be the negative of listing it on the MLS as a realtor? Because then it becomes a comp, especially if it's higher.
Yeah, you're thinking like they might get more offers, but if they have an acceptable offer and it's in-house and they know the team is going to close it, that's where it goes. It goes to a yes answer that's easy.
Exactly. So we're talking about end-user type of properties right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Okay. So if that's the case, do we know like how that sort of tracks back so other realtors, because realtors are usually using the MLS for comps and BPOs and whatnot, right?
They're using that, but they're also using their tax data.
Okay.
They're using Realist, things like that.
So it'll show up even if it's not in the MLS at some point. I want to check that out, how long it takes.
What's interesting, you know, it's changed in our landscape, is we used to be able to hide our doc stamps.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, now with the access of information, everybody knows what we paid for something.
Mm-hmm.
So now as investors, we have to justify why we feel we bought something for $225 and now we want to sell it for $325.
Yeah.
Because people didn't used to have access to what we paid for something if we hit our doc stamps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's really a change from not that long ago.
Well, it affects how much you can get for the property. If you have the wrong buyer, it's got to get a FHA loan. You can only have a certain markup within a certain time period.
Right.
And dual appraisals and that type of thing.
And you have to be able to tell the story too, right? They're like, why is it this much more?
Right. But that's what's really icing, you know, like you said, in quadrant four right now, people really aren't questioning that. But when we're not in quadrant four, they're asking, you know, why should I pay $100,000 more for this house than what you purchased it for? Because they have access to all that information.
Okay. Well, is there anything specific that you look for in the existing inventory? So we've already sorted days on market.
I love the days on market for a couple of reasons, because if something falls out of escrow, an agent doesn't necessarily cancel their listing and then relist it.
Okay.
So something can have 120 or 160 days on market. It might be that because it's fallen out of escrow a couple of times.
Mm.
And it's just the clock keeps ticking on the MLS.
So when you see backup, does that stop you from writing an offer?
I don't actually really ever look at the backups.
No?
I really don't. To me...
Look at you. She's all, I don't care.
No, it's not that. It's just that we're talking about days on market. You know, my strategy, the one I just bought in Yucaipa, that was a bank REO, that had long days on market because it had fallen out of escrow for a couple times, and it had an extremely difficult agent to reach. And he had an old lockbox on it, the ones we're not supposed to use anymore, the short Supras that you...
Okay.
Your keys don't... You know how everyone uses their smartphone now?
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't use your smartphone to access the Supra.
Interesting.
You had to have an adapter. So he sent me an email that said, go to the board and get an adapter.
Wow.
I'm like, I love you.
Yeah. You just eliminated 99% of
exactly.
the world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I bought that house.
Yeah.
You know, so
wow.
Long days on the market, a difficult agent to work with, the wrong ML, the Supra box on it, and then, you know, go get an adapter.
Yeah. Do you have any other listings that you're not interested in selling?
That's bad. Well, I'll end the segment with, you know, we always get a lot of new people who, you know, if you were first getting started, you know, where do you start in the quadrant? If you were brand new, we sort of covered it briefly, a brief mention of it doesn't have to be your comp. You can walk the comp whether it's yours or not.
Correct.
So if you're doing some research and maybe you're, it can get expensive in, like, say, quadrant four as you're trying to market to equity sellers that aren't going to go through the MLS or a realtor. You can take the comp and maybe beat up existing MLS without incurring the cost of spending tens of thousands of dollars on mailers and paid ads and whatnot. This is a good strategy for that?
It's a good strategy for two things. It's a good strategy for education. Because you're forcing yourself, you're taking a chunk of, and you're really becoming knowledgeable. And what I want to do, time is a really good factor. And also, if it's listed at, let's say, less than 90% of what you know it's worth. So somebody's got a motivation there. Now, maybe it's the house has got a problem or whatever. But that's where I would start, is somebody's leaning toward, I'm already taking a discount and allowing to see if they'll take a bigger one.
Okay, that's fair. All right.
And you, every time you follow up an offer, too, you're always able to say, do you have anything else? So you call the agent, and if you bug them enough, it's like, all right, I've got this thing that's coming up. And that's so good.
Yeah, we love those words, actually. This one's coming up.
Okay.
Those are good words.
Yeah, and now you can double end it, and there you go. Now you have basically transferred that to the first buying system. You've now got a pre-MLS deal.
Okay.
But it came from your follow-up.
Okay. Very nice.
I think, too, when you're looking at, if we're just discussing the MLS, one of the things that I always look for, too, are out-of-area agents.
Yeah, very good.
You know, that's a big deal. I mean, one of the ones that we bought last year, I'm not kidding, it was Rodeo Realty, actually on Rodeo Drive.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a listing in Moreno Valley. And I'm thinking, this agent is never going to drive from Beverly Hills to Moreno Valley.
They consider a garage.
Okay. Yeah. And he was great. And he worked for a company that had bought a whole portfolio of properties.
Oh.
And they just happened to have this one in Moreno Valley. And, you know, I talked to him. And it goes actually ties back into your first day MLS. And, you know, we ended up buying that property in Moreno Valley. But it was because this guy wanted nothing to do with ever having to drive to Moreno Valley. And I was, like, telling him, hey, I'll take pictures. I'll go get your lockbox off for you. All of that stuff.
See, it helps that she knows the drill.
Right.
I mean, so you're able to do a lot of that for the agent. That's really a good idea.
You're helping tell the story of how to get the discount.
I was emailing him pictures of his property and all kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm working on that right now with this absentee seller. You know, took pictures of, I mean, this family has gotten up on the roof and started patching holes. Like, I have to assume there's mold.
Maybe
in this
you could
place.
Find one that's burnt down and say, it's almost too late.
Okay, I'm here. Well, thanks for covering this. This ended up being over a half hour, so this is good stuff. So,
okay.
Anything else you can think of about the existing inventory? Any last tips? Any difference in the amount offered down as far as a deposit or?
Well, an existing inventory, I always do research on what they owe on it.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, are we existing inventory and, you know, we have an $80,000 note that's recorded, or are we existing inventory and, you know, we have no money,
no equity?
So that's one of the things that I always look at when I'm looking at existing inventory.
That's pretty smart. Make sure you're not dealing with a short sale situation if you're getting under a number that they would need to accomplish.
Right. I mean, my biggest thing is I always just want to find out what their motivation is.
Okay.
You know.
And who will tell you that? Well, I mean, working through a realtor, if it's existing, will realtors disclose that?
You know, I always try to create that dialogue, though.
Yeah. With another realtor, that's one of the reasons you have a license, is they'll tell other realtors stuff they won't tell an investor.
Ah,
you know,
that's interesting.
It is. And
I don't think I've ever heard you say that before.
Yeah, it's in the recording of the stuff. It is. And that's why it's sort of like when I met an appraiser, I wanted to be one of him. I got that training so I could hold the end of the tape and we could have a conversation that I understood his language.
Mm. Okay.
I want to say something really important, and I almost forgotten, and I think I mentioned it, but I want to say the most important thing about Quadrant 2 was to get to inventory that was coming up. And I don't think I made that point specific enough. So you're following up on stuff, and the question is, do you have anything else coming up?
Okay.
And so I'm trying to get to Quadrant 1, even though I'm doing Quadrant 2. You'll get some of those, but the goal is to become that agent's go-to person for that thing that's going to come up that's pretty cool.
Okay. Would an agent ever let an investor, maybe if they knew an REO was coming up, go take pictures for them?
Like I said, I've offered to do a lot of things when we're talking about out of area agents. I mean, because they don't want to drive from Beverly Hills or Monrovia or wherever their office is.
Okay.
So.
I want to say one other thing about the power of an offer. I remember you were involved in the transaction. There was three triplexes in Paris. They got listed for $30,000. And I about had a heart attack. Was that one of the things she faxed over to me? So, I mean, the first sound you could hear, the car starting. I drove down there, looked at the came back, and I just knew there was going to be a ton of offers. And it was a pretty well-known REO agent that had. And there was a line, like it was the Krispy Kreme donut place with offers. And I had gone to the bank and got a cashier's check for the full amount and the closing cost. And I was standing in line. And I got to talk to him. He said, oh, Bruce Norris, I've heard of you. I've never met you. And he said, we have a lot of offers on this. I said, I don't really think you'll consider that you do have any offers after this. And I handed him the offer, and he looked at the cashier's check, and he says, yeah. I said, I don't see any other offers. And that was it. We were in escrow. So all the other offers went away because this was going to close.
And you had a reputation. That's good.
Yeah, I can't stress that enough. I mean, as a realtor and as an investor, do your due diligence, because agents do not like to have their time wasted. go look at the property, actually see the property, do your numbers, calculate it, and then write your best offer.
The other thing, too, is their reputation's on the line when you get to play games. So you're in escrow, and then you find out they look bad to their client. Who? What's if it's a lender? Well, behind the agent that actually has the account is 20 more agents that want the account.
Yeah.
And you have a very short shelf life. If you have escrows that keep falling out, you're going to lose that account to somebody that's going to give it another shot.
Hmm. Yeah, and for regular sellers, it's really stressful. I mean, we just bought one out in Cherry Valley that both people had lost their jobs. Their house mm-hmm. was really run down. Their pool was empty. Their air conditioner didn't work. And your dad taught me this, I didn't go there to buy their house. I went there and asked him, what is it you need and how can we help you get there? Maybe it's buying your house, but maybe it's not.
Maybe it's brainstorming. But, what happened for them is they got a fresh start, which they needed.
Correct.
Yeah, because they weren't going to be able to fix this one.
Exactly.
But now they can go and have a fresh start and play another day.
So I think as an investor, and again, I keep saying your dad taught this to me, but he really did, you need to have empathy and you need to understand people's circumstances and how you can help them. Because you really are there as an investor. It's not that you're trying to make money off of them. You're trying to help them get maybe to another place in their life if you're dealing with a regular seller.
That Ben Gay's book, that infiltrator, sales infiltrator chapter, if you really become that, and it's not a game, it's not a manipulation, you really are caring about what you're doing, people respond very positively to someone they're not fear, they don't have a fear of. Okay. They kind of pick up, I'll tell the whole thing. I'll tell the whole story, and now you actually can help because you're the only one that heard the whole deal. And then you can go, well, for me, I would do this, and here's why. And that's usually when I bought a home is when I had concluded if I was sitting in your seat, I would do it myself.
Last question specifically for you because you have both hats, the ability. Do you offer both hats? You're willing to do either or?
The listing and the buying?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, when I go out like the Cherry Valley or we just bought a short sale in Riverside, that deal got brought to me actually by a friend. She went out there and talked to them and they had one of those loans that you've been talking about, that 10-year adjustment.
Okay.
So they were basically renting this house. I mean, their house payment was like $1,300, and then it was adjusting to like almost $3,000.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Oh. I mean, what their only solution is moving.
Right.
And being a short sale. But, when you're talking to people like that, you are saying, we can list this house for you and here's what it's going to cost. And, if you're able to, the best thing is to just go ahead and sell it to an investor. And yeah, we do give them both options.
Okay.
But I'm very careful in that. Again, I listen to what their story is and where they're needing to go and what is the best way for us to help them get there.
We got a little off topic because that's not quite existing inventory, but I just wanted to ask, why not?
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay. Well, good. Anything else for this strategy?
No.
More to come.